Welcome to Conductor's Brew. I am Larry Spell, and Matt, we are back in the front yard, my friend. Larry, the weather has finally paid,
it's so nice to hear you. It's so nice to hear your voice like in person without a strange delay.
Well, we have all kinds of other strangeness, strange sounds.
Yeah, and we have other strangeness involved in our personalities anyway.
So that's true.
Sort of makes up for itself.
Yes, but it's good to be back with our original strangeness of random sounds in the neighborhood. It's quiet right now, but, you know, FedEx will,
that will
is always
last.
On the move.
No. No, it's glorious out. It's got to be close to 50 degrees already, and it's only, what, 11? So
yeah.
We're heading up towards 60 today. Woohoo! What a tease. It's just not fair.
Yeah, it's going to be nice for a while. We will dip back down a little bit, and we always get the pre-tax day snowfall. Like right around April 15th.
Winter's got a long way to go.
We get our tax stuff going on. So anyway, we're here in the front yard, and it's an extra special day because we'd say maybe the full crew.
This is
like a full complement.
Yeah.
Aboard our podcast ship.
I would say so. Are you part of the crew, Ash?
He's a crew.
You're definitely at least a returning guest.
I think this is the fourth time I'm on the show, probably.
Well, then you're definitely in the crew.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
What's the limit? Is that like three or two?
It depends on how much you pay Matt.
And how much coffee we've had. Yeah. And Brandon's
back with us
in the yard as well.
Yep.
Hello, Brandon.
Hello. Happy to be back.
And Matt McKeever is with us again from an as-yet-to-be-disclosed location.
Somewhere in the great up north.
Somewhere in Wisconsin.
Yeah, exactly. McKeever, how you doing? You back, man?
I'm back. It's good to see y'all.
All right.
So today, we have, thankfully, much to discuss, as always. But first, the most important thing of the day. What are we all drinking?
Well, you tell us, Matt. You made it for me.
All right, I'll start. Ah, thank you very much, Larry.
Yeah, you
threw me a meatball there. That's great.
Well,
I will take it.
I don't know. I'm just drinking it.
So this is an Ethiopian.
Hmm.
This is Wasatch Roasting Company out of Ogden, Utah, right up the road. It's a very, very light, nicely cinnamony colored light roast. I mean, it's just such a beautiful color.
Yeah.
And this is made in the Siphon Brewer this morning, and I made up three different batches and then combined them all and then split them back up into three different cups. So we're all drinking exactly the same thing.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Made in the Siphon Brewer. Yeah. So the tasting notes on this are melon, cherry, limeade, and bergamot.
Ooh, bergamot, like in Earl Grey.
Yes, exactly.
So
ding,
I,
ding, ding, you get 10 points.
Well, I'm a big fan of the Star Trek. So,
Earl Grey.
You know all about Earl Grey if you like Star Trek. It was sad though when I walked to the microwave as a kid and said Earl Grey hot and nothing came out. But then
dream,
I learned how to work the microwave and it was okay.
So what do you think, guys? This is Ashkan, we haven't heard from you in quite some time. So what do you think about this coffee compared to what you normally drink?
Well, in general, when I drink your coffee here, is that the Siphon method? Okay. It's just lighter in general compared to what I drink every day.
Lighter, like
as far as the taste of
it.
But I mean, the color of it is. I mean, my mug is pretty blue. I can't really see. It's not transparent, but
blue coffee.
Yeah. I can tell that the color of it is also like light brown compared to really dark, almost black coffee that I drink.
Yeah, it looks like it's almost an orange color.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I should serve this in glass mugs at some point
just to see
what it looks like. Yeah, it looks gorgeous when I'm brewing it. It's in the upper siphon. It's like this vibrant orange turns to kind of this wonderfully chestnutty brown.
Yeah, and then also the Ethiopian, is that how you say it?
Ethiopian.
Ethiopian. Because in Farsi you say Ethiopian.
Anyways. Oh, cool. Same word. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, so that is also there, because when I actually drink that coffee, it's got a little bit of a sourness to it.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if
I agree.
You experienced that too or not. Yeah, so that's there too. So, pretty
Larry?
Delicious.
Well, Matt, it's because it's been so long since I've been in the yard with your coffee, it's everything is a head and shoulders above the swill that I usually make for myself.
The drip swill.
So I don't know how. The siphon I have, I've been making some good stuff, and the drip can be okay. But no, this is delightful. Hold on a second.
Yeah.
No turkey flavor.
No turkey.
It's okay,
no turkey this time.
No turkey this time, it does have a lot of complexity to it. So I'm enjoying it, and thank you so much for once again being a gracious host.
Oh, my pleasure.
With the beverage, not only the location, but the fine refreshments.
I had a beverage in hand for you this morning.
You did. When I showed up here late, as my,
I even knew you were going to have a mug somehow.
I did remember the mug. I thought I'd forgotten it, but anyway.
Oh, you did.
Actually did remember to bring my mug. Right. I forgot the speakers to hook up the Zoom call for McKeever and had to come back and was once again late, but alas.
So I just want to touch on something Ashkan said, which was sourness.
Mm-hmm.
When I drink these African, like these Ethiopian Kenyan coffees in particular, they have like this like fruitiness to them that I would say maybe is a sourness.
Yeah.
Like when you bite into a fresh citrus fruit or like a pear or something, but it's like a juicy sour. It's the satisfying kind of like mouth, like, I don't know. It kind of lights your mouth up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little
puckery.
Yeah, puckery. Exactly. That's a good word for it. And it's bright. It feels bright. So
it's definitely pleasant. Like, it's not an unpleasant sourness.
Oh, thank you very much.
And this is from a roaster in Ogden, you said?
Yes, this is Wasatch Roasting Company.
Gotta love Ogden.
Yeah. No, I can't take credit for this. The roaster pretty much does all the work.
Do they have a shop, like a coffee shop associated with it, or are they just strictly, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I found this. This was actually a gift, but I've seen it in supermarkets.
I think they do.
Yeah?
But I don't know for sure.
I hope they have a storefront.
I think they do.
A lot of places are starting to open back up partially, which is really great. Hopefully in a couple months here, knock on wood, we'll be actually in what's the word I'm looking for? A coffee shop. Thank you.
A coffee shop. Yeah. Or pub.
Or a pub.
Yeah,
indeed.
Depending on the day.
Brandon, what are you drinking?
Well, speaking of puckeriness, this is the always pleasant and nicely chilled with light ice. The Trenta Kiwi Starfruit Refresher from Starbucks.
Ooh, yeah.
So it's
a little
is,
chunky there.
This is also puckery because the starfruit has a little bit of a bitterness to it. It's like a really crunchy, juicy apple.
Oh, yeah.
And then they add the kiwis, which are these freeze-dried things that taste interesting.
Looks like you get like a salad floating on top there.
It is kind of like a fruit salad if this was like a Jell-O, which is appropriate for Utah, actually.
Okay, yeah, so you don't want to take up a lot of time. Why is Jell-O a thing in Utah?
Is it? I didn't even know that until just now.
Honestly, I don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't really know the origins of all of that. It has to do with the LDS Mormon church thing. Of having Jell-O on Sundays.
Why Jell-O on Sundays?
I don't know why Jell-O. It just was a thing. Everybody did it. Everybody made Jell-O all the time.
Wine is huge in Christianity. Probably, but then you can't do the
that. You can call it Jell-O red. You can make it Jell-O shots. You can make it actually alcohol.
I know. It was really big in the 60s and 70s. I had it as a kid growing up all through the 80s and stuff like that.
Well, Jell-O was kind of big all over in that time. I guess Utah just never kind of got rid of the Jell-O.
Well, Utah's thing was always Jell-O, ice cream, and antidepressants. So,
hey man,
those
you're
are the
not
big
wrong.
Three.
Whatever gets
you're
you through your day.
Those are the big three for Utah.
All right.
And
work.
What, Andy?
Fry sauce.
Yes.
Upper neighbor has a cameo on the show.
Whenever
today,
I say it's a combination of mayo and ketchup, it gets offended.
It is. That's the basis.
And like Thousand Island
stuff.
There's
some relish in there somewhere. I think
a little bit of like relish juice or
some ketchup.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. I took the show on a turn into a weird Utah culture.
What's McKeever drinking?
Yeah, McKeever, don't you wish you had a front yard with us?
You know, I have to interject very quickly before I get onto my coffee, and I have to say that Ashkan is onto something with the mayo and ketchup thing. Heinz makes a combination of mayo and ketchup called Mayo Chup.
Ooh.
Oh.
Do they market it that way?
Yes, and it really offended people from Utah, though. There was a big uproar about that.
Brendan knows about this. It's already a thing.
This was like a couple of years, or last year or the year before.
All right, I don't care that we're derailing the show here. You have to tell us about this. Tell us the story.
There was an uproar because Heinz was then claiming that they were the inventor of this kind of fry sauce, and Utahns were like, no.
It was Crown Burger, right?
We've been doing it since
1800. Yeah, I think it was the Crown Burger. Crown Burger, Apollo Burger, they both have great fry sauce. B&D's up by the university has great fry sauce. So
I didn't know it was a thing. I mean, I love fry sauce.
Utahns are very protective of their fry sauce.
You know, Americans think the French are weird for dipping their French fries in mayonnaise. I think it's delicious.
I'm down with
it. If you just, own it and open your heart to that, the mayonnaise thing, literally and figuratively, because God knows you're not making it any easier to to pump blood through your system.
How is it possible to blame French from like dipping their French fries in whatever they don't?
Oh, I don't know.
They it's their fries. They can dip them whatever they want.
Yeah, you know,
was that their toast as well?
There was a movement a while back to call them to rename them Freedom Fries.
So that was my old congressman from North Carolina who kind of touched off on that.
Oh God,
yeah.
Freedom
Let's not get into that.
Yeah,
let's not get into that. Yes.
What about dipping donuts in coffee? Is that allowed?
Well, they all go to the same place.
What?
You know, you're gonna
well, then you could dunk anything and eat it.
That's right.
Okay. The show could take a turn.
You know, Matt, to each their own.
McKeever, what are you drinking?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's get onto the topic.
I am drinking a small batch Bolivian from Stone Creek Coffee called High Road. It's a light roast. And the tasting notes are lemon custard, honey, and Chardonnay.
Ooh.
I definitely get a lot of the lemon in
That's
it.
Some highbrow coffee, man. Do you taste the custard? Does it have some custardy notes?
Tastes like egg?
It doesn't have that doesn't have egg in it. No, no.
What time is it in Wisconsin, right? Is it 9 p.m. or
it's like dessert and coffee, dude.
He's already into the Chardonnay there. day drinking with Matt.
Yeah, how do you pick up on a Chardonnay tasting note? Like,
depends on if you're drinking wine with it or not.
I guess that's true. Well, you know what we should do sometime? Just for the hell of it, just for the fun of it, I'm going to pick a bag that has some really outlandish tasting notes, and I'm going to either make or purchase good versions of all the items on those tasting notes, and then we will eat the tasting notes along with the coffee.
Ah.
And we will actually test these guys to see if they're being truthful or not.
Okay, we'll put it to a test.
Yeah.
All right.
How subjective
like
is it? Is there any sort of like world governing body that has guidelines
the International
about this
Coffee
sort of
Council?
Thing? Like, is this more important to me now? I'm not sure why. Probably because I want to know.
Yeah. No,
well,
I like that.
You get a thing and you go with it and you don't go half.
Yeah, that's
but that's good. That's good.
You know, I was thinking about this last night, Larry.
Yeah.
If I may wax somewhat philosophical for a
Please.
Moment, there's just so much about. It must be the warmer weather. I'm just feeling very bubbly today. There's just so much about life to enjoy, and I promise I've only been drinking coffee this morning so far. There's just so much. I have a really hard time just focusing on a few things at a time. Like I just want to do everything. You know, lately it's been space. I'm really getting into space.
Into space.
Not literally, but I wouldn't mind, you know. It's just... Anyway, all right.
The cool thing about it is just what direction you go, you just find a lot of stuff that you can
That's
focus
right.
on. It's just, it's
That's
just
right.
amazing.
Wait, in space? Anywhere.
I mean, you talk about anything. Like, just
it
like,
might take a while.
Take, like, I don't know, like a leaf and then just start, I don't know, researching that. And then... There's no end to it.
That's true.
I go down these Wikipedia wormholes.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And it's like 4 a.m, and I've learned about, you know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you know, things I never knew I needed to know.
No, I love it. You know what I've discovered recently is Instagram. I know I'm like 80 years behind. But,
you know, Matt, there's this thing called the
interwebs. I have no idea
what
Insta stories are. I don't get it.
I discovered that I actually downloaded it onto my phone.
Yeah.
To be able to watch my girlfriend's feed. And I forgot that I downloaded it because it was, you know, I'm one of those people that has to have all of their apps on the front page of their phone.
Oh, okay.
Right? You know, it's all organized, so I never flip to the next page. So I was like looking for this other app that I downloaded. I think it was like the Amazon Prime Video app or something. I'm like, where is it? It's got to be here. So I scroll over to the right, and there's Instagram and like some other avalanche warning app or something, and then this, and then the Amazon Prime one. And I'm like, wow, you know, Instagram, let's see what's going on. I did not realize how much fun. I didn't realize how evil Instagram was. It is just as bad as Facebook. You can just get into this rabbit hole and just keep watching.
Facebook.
Oh, is
it? It is.
Well,
there it is.
I don't need to say anything else
about
that.
But that's what the kids are doing these days.
It's the kids. The kids and the pictures and the stories and such.
I feel old.
Yeah, that's all right.
There's also this TV that they have. What is it? RGT? Something TV? Instagram?
Instagram TV? I have Instagram TV.
Instagram Everybody TV. Everybody pulling out their
phones. Well, I mean, if you want to upload like a longer video, because I think there's a limit.
Yeah.
Like it's like a 1 minute. But if you want to go longer, then they just upload it to their TV, and then you sort of click on it, and it goes to the TV.
That's why it's so addicting, though, is because there's that limit. And so as soon as one video ends, before you even have time to digest it, you're watching something else that's different. That is brilliant. It's designed for amazingly short attention spans. And maybe to train our attention spans too. I wonder how much research has been done on that. If like we actually are viewing and listening, if our comprehension habits change, as we view more social media. But anyway, I suppose we should kind of get on to some other things.
Yeah, you know, the show is about a half over to, at this point. No, I'm just
I wanted to reintroduce Ashkan.
Yeah, we've got
a
nerd
while
moment.
Since he's had some time with us here, and he's been up to some really interesting things. Ashkan finished his, this is Ashkan Tabataboy, he finished his PhD in music composition in, last year now.
Wow. Yeah. So December 11th of 2020, I guess, okay. is the official date.
So congratulations, Dr. Tabataboy. Yeah. And you are currently a postdoctoral research assistant at the College of Health at the University of Utah.
Correct.
And doing some interesting things there, which we'll get into in a moment. And he's also the chief executive officer of this amazing new digital content production company. I think I said that right.
I'm digital sure. content, Helix. Yeah.
Digital content, Helix.
How
we
like to call it Helix. Yes. Yeah.
Helix for short. So you've been busy. You are busy. Tomorrow, in fact, you have a conference talk that you're giving about this paper that you sent me during this week that I read and is fascinating. And then the day after that, Helix has this Earth Activism Project Phase 2. You mentioned that you thought this was related because they both of these things look at music and art in a more universal way. And I'm just curious what you meant by that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me again. Let's start with the article. this article basically is going to be presented in the conference, the Future Direction of Music Cognition conference. And it's really amazing because it's the first conference, but this is going to be the first meeting of conference. So it's really delightful that I'm going to be in the first conference.
So So is it online this time around?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I submitted the proposal a year ago and before the pandemic. And
I see.
The conference is hosted by Ohio State University. So we were supposed to basically go there and present there. And I've been there before at the Ohio State University. I actually went there to participate in Professor Huron, David Huron is. Was one of the pioneers in music perception and cognition. I was actually his last workshop. It was like, and he had what it did in his last workshop, in his last class that he taught ever. It was an honor actually to be there. And what he did, he put everything together, squeezed it in like a four-day workshop, and he sort of taught what he would usually teach in a semester.
Wow.
So it was
4 days.
In 4 days, that's intense. Yeah. It was really intense. And yeah, I made a lot of connections. And then they started this conference. It's called the Future Direction of Music Cognition, which I like a lot. The name of it is just great.
Well, that's your... You've been fascinated by that sort of thing as long as I've known you. You have an undergraduate degree, is that correct, in neuroscience?
My undergraduate is not related, I have background in the neuroscience I did in my master's degree.
Thank you, I always screw that up.
Yeah, I have another publication that is... out of my master's thesis, and that was it was published in a neuroscience journal. About the article is sort of like a snippet of what I did for my dissertation, the research part of my dissertation, aside from the composition. And I remember that I was talking about that in this show it was a piece by James Tenney, is like an American composer, and he wrote this piece based on a psychophysical concept called critical band. I analyzed in my dissertation, but and also the analysis of that piece was done through various approaches. One of them was like a score analysis that you usually do in music theory, and then the other part was an acoustic analysis that a lot of computer scientists do. They just take the audio file and then do a lot of acoustic analysis on the audio file to sort of understand a few things that maybe we can't really understand from the score. And the other thing that I added was a model analysis. The model was based on a human cochlear model, and basically we took the audio file, a simulation of one snippet of the composition, and we fed it into the model. And we look at, and the model, let me just explain about the model. The model was basically developed by Zilani et al. In 2014, if I'm not wrong. And then it's been getting developed ever since by other scientists. And it's great because what they do, they simulated all of the whole auditory system up to the the auditory nerve. It actually goes up to the auditory cortex.
It's incredible in a computer. And they just simulated this incredibly complex organic part of our body.
And it's based on animal studies and human psychoacoustic studies.
Was it cats, if I remember?
Some of them are cats and other animals, and also psychoacoustic, but you can't really test a lot of stuff on human because you have limitations. Mm-hmm. So you take the hardcore tests on animals, but then psychoacoustic-wise, you do it on human, and then you create a model. And the cool thing about a model is that you can refine your perception of studies with the model, so you can make a hypothesis. Because those perception studies are expensive, time-consuming, all that.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So this is really kind of a, if I understand you correctly, this model that was developed can be a great shortcut for anticipating how human beings perceive sound. And it goes beyond other models that we've had before because it can anticipate how the actual physical components of the ear, the cochlea in particular, will almost interfere with that sound and create their own artifacts in the sound. Exactly. Whereas typical computer models, they can't do that. They can just interpret what the sound is emanating from the source.
Exactly. And that's the premise of this paper. I did a score analysis and then an acoustic analysis on the sound file and then an analysis on the output of the inner hair cells.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then we'll see how the acoustic analysis is different from the output and see what actually the auditory system adds to the acoustic sound as it travels through and goes. And critical band is amazing because we know critical band happens at the inner hair cells level. Okay. So that's why we looked at the output of inner hair cells to sort of see. And we expected to see beatings and roughness in timbre in the score analysis based on the theoretical frameworks that we had.
Yeah.
And then we actually, it was consistent with the results of the model analysis.
Okay.
So that was pretty cool. Yeah. And that was one of the papers that I've probably written. Hey, hello.
So to recap a little bit then, this critical band is it a threshold or is it a range of sound?
Yeah.
And so what we're trying to figure out is when you take two pitches that are really, really close together, at what point is the ear not able to distinguish the two pitches anymore? And what happens as a result? So when two student saxophone players are playing the same note but a little bit out of tune, you hear that beating sound. Like any music teacher and anybody who's familiar with this instrument playing thing will understand what this means. Like when you're just a little bit out of tune, you hear wah 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 wah, or beats. And that's the beating of the roughness that you're talking about. Is that right? And that's the result of the physical way our brain or our ears, rather, not our brains, our ears actually take or input that energy. Right? There's like portions of the cochlea that can only resonate in sympathy to certain frequencies.
And that's the critical band.
And that's the critical band. Yeah. And so that's why Tenney named the piece that, because he was trying to play with that ear. It's not just like some sound that you can create and enjoy. It's like actually making use of the inner, rather the cochlea, as a part of the compositional process.
Exactly. And being in charge of that from the beginning.
That's amazing.
I mean, because a lot of times as a composer, you put things together and then a lot of it is like, okay, let's see what happens, you know, because you don't know. I mean, you have some experience. You can rely on your experiences, your oral trainings and all that. But when you get to that level, that everything is like micro level, you really can't anticipate unless you do a computer simulation and try to understand how it sounds. But then take that and then make a whole composition out of that specific element. It's just fascinating.
By the way,
I got to give credit to my PI, who actually helped me with that, Skylar Jennings, and then the model simulation and all that, he helped me a lot with that. So, and it was great because he has a mentor in Rochester University, Laura Carney, and she has a lab, is totally in auditory perception and physiology. And Laura has a student from Eastman. He's a theorist, and he did a Braden Maxwell. He did a summer fellowship in her lap, mm-hmm. and so he learned a little bit about the modeling, and not a little bit, probably a lot, mm-hmm. about the modeling and stuff. And he's using that model as well that we're okay. using, and he's presenting right before me.
Oh, wow.
In the conference, and it's just like this kind of a synchronicity.
I'd love to see where you two overlap yeah. and where you disagree.
And we all know that when something like happens once, it's, yeah. it can be an accident, you forget. But when two people converge, you know, it's kind of like,
well, that's true. Yeah, really the cool. science is never really conclusive. But yeah. if you have just one result that says a certain thing, it really doesn't mean much.
Yeah.
But when you have two or more, then all of a sudden we're talking about a pattern.
Exactly.
And we're talking about something that is heavily supported by the evidence, which yeah. is really thrilling. So what's the takeaway? Like, what's the future application potentially of this?
Yeah, I'm really interested in taking this model and look at different stages of the perception. So far I'm right at the inner Husserl
okay.
Output of, but then after that we have the synaptic output of the auditory nerve, and then after that we have other levels up
okay.
Between the output of the auditory nerve and then the auditory cortex where the perception actually happens.
So we haven't even gotten near the brain yet, really.
we're not there.
So
we're right before okay. It's just the input for the auditory nerve.
Okay.
So the auditory nerve adds its own stuff, and then the auditory cortex is where perception happens. Amazing.
And the more we learn about that, the more that helps us understand how our ears, how our auditory functions work.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to be rewriting textbooks, I think, pretty soon.
The cool thing about it, as a compositional standpoint, you can take that model and just whatever you want to sort of experiment with to see
yeah.
how it's going to be perceived, you can just give it to the model and sort of have a prediction, and then it's a little bit more reliable than just guessing.
Okay. You know? And then you can use that as a way to compose then.
Exactly.
If you know what the projected outcome is, then you can work backwards. You can kind of reverse engineer that. That's
and
amazing.
I'm actually really interested in
really
new stuff, you know, like experimental stuff that we probably don't have a lot of experience in as composers. Like when we're talking about really close tones, like we're talking about like maybe 1 hertz, 2 hertz difference between the tones. I mean, we don't have the oral skill to
it's understand. It's not part of our traditional music training.
Yeah.
Very briefly, tell us about this Artivism for Earth project that Helix is doing.
Yeah. So that's an art part of my life that basically just doing stuff with Helix, which is it's great right now, in good shape. So that was, I think it was a grant from a grant. Some of the faculty members of the university, specifically School of Music, I think Elizabeth Corbella and Hossa Burra, they're in charge of that grant money. And I think this project is sponsored by the University of Utah. It's for climate change awareness.
Mm.
And they, I think, commissioned multiple composers around the country, and they wrote some pieces with that theme. So they came up with this fascinating composition. Some of them are based on data, like scientific data. Some people went to Alaska and just recorded the ice like melting, and they just
the sound of it.
Yeah, the sound of it, and they made composition with it. Anyway, so what we do, our role, they hired us to basically produce the video recordings and the sound recording, and also create augmented reality visuals to just basically map or project on some cool places in the Utah Museum of Natural History. So basically we are in charge of that, and it's been, we had 2 recording sessions for 2 pieces so far. We're going to have 4 more in the upcoming days, and the President Watkins is going to give a statement on the 9th about this whole project and the climate.
And you're recording it.
And we're recording.
Oh, neat. Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. Yeah. I can't wait to hear more about that, and also the comparison between yours and Braden Maxwell's results on the music cognition stuff. But this climate change thing, it's not just, you know, a national issue. It's a universal issue. And that takes us into, finally, our topic of the day, Larry.
That was a fun segue there, man.
Nailed it.
I don't think I ever answered your question, like how they're, like why it's universal, what I mean by it. But I just let...
Well, that's what Larry, NAR is for.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I tried to explain everything, but
No, we'll get into this.
Yes, so we're talking about... So our discussion topic today thank you for that segue, Matt, is about nationalism, and nationalism in music, of course. But I wanted to kind of sort of set the table with this idea of nationalism and like how nations are defined. And I think that becomes kind of a bit of the sticky issue sometimes. You know, when you think about nations in Europe, you know, if you think about the European traditional music, you think about nationalism defined as people with a common language, people with a common history, and that's kind of you know, creating of the nation state. And then you think about like a country like the United States, you know, we're more of the melting pot, and we have people from all over the world coming to it. I mean, we were, you know, from the beginning, people coming from lots of different places, and so our nationalism. I mean, there's people in this country who, you know, kind of do think we're a monolithic culture or seek to be that, but that's just not the case. Mm-hmm. But the point is that how a nation is defined defines itself. You know, that's you see that reflected in the music. So anyway, I'm just kind of curious. So what makes a nation? I kind of wanted to throw that topic out there, and how do we see that reflected in music? So, Brandon, anybody want to go first? McKeever, are you there?
I am here, but I want to throw it to someone else first.
Okay, McKeever's not jumping in. Yeah,
that's a big topic. I agree with you, Larry, that I think that music will definitely follow the culture that's being established by any society. Mm-hmm. And maybe that actually helps shape what the society values and takes upon itself as ownership over, saying, well, this is ours. This is what it means to be X, you know. This is what it means to be Russian. This is what it means to be a German. This is what it means to be Middle Eastern. I don't know. Because those kind of things we adopt as our own. And yet, I wonder, when you mentioned this topic that we were going to do this week, my first thought was, you know, can any one nation claim that this is theirs, musically?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question.
Yes, I mean, there might be some folk elements to it, or some, you know, the history or the tradition that comes from it, from those regions or from those areas, and so, yeah, okay, that's inherently Bohemian or whatever, but...
Or Hungarian, or
yeah, whatever, but know? Can you claim that as like it's ours, you know? And yet, I think we've been accustomed to knowing that if we hear something, we're like, oh, that sounds like this, you know. This sound, you know, you listen to Shostakovich, you listen to Tchaikovsky, you go, oh, that sounds Russian. Well, why?
Yeah,
because of the marching beats, because of the dissonances. You know, what is it? So that's kind of where my mind went. Is like, well, what elements of music? How do we define that? This is why we say this is this country's music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree, Brandon, completely. I've often wondered why, you know, what is it that makes American music sound American? And we've talked about this before.
We had Copeland, American
music, the fifths
show.
And the fourths and all that.
Yeah.
But, Larry, when you asked, you know, what defines a nation, I think we could probably all agree that it's not simply its political borders, right? That's not what defines a nation.
Right, 100%. That's a state, right?
Yes.
Because you can have a nation without a state.
Yeah.
So, you know, think like the Kurds, right? They don't. They're a group of people, but they don't have their own state. So a nation and a state are not necessarily the same thing.
So when we're talking about the music that's being influenced by a nation or a culture, this is why I'm so confused about the world sometimes, because we all affect each other. There's no such thing as being separate from each other, because we are on this planet together. I really, especially in the 21st century, when geographical borders don't really mean as much as they used to, because we can fly everywhere and we can also communicate with each other instantly. Where do we get the gumption to say, like, oh, this belongs to us or this belongs to you, but it belonged to us first or something? Or it's Persian first, I don't know. Yeah, like where does that come from, and what is it? Why do we still hold on to that? I think that creates a lot of issues.
Well, that's sort of the larger debate about, you know, what does it mean to be a nation? Like, why is that important? And I think that's kind of a debate that a nation needs to have. I think, like I said, traditionally it's been centered around people who have a common language, common history. And so to kind of get it, we're kind of dancing around the issue a bit of, like, is nationalism an important thing to reflect in music? I mean, should that be something that we do? And to take a historical perspective, when I think of nationalism, I think of it really getting started in earnest in the 19th century. And, you know, you think about Europe at the time of the early 19th century. We've just had the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, and, you know, just a real time of like, national fervor. And one thing I was reading about, it's kind of interesting, just as a side note, is that, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think that in the Napoleonic Wars was sort of the first time there was these large-scale armies that were made up of just the people exclusively, or mostly exclusively from that country, whereas before, you would have a lot of mercenaries. I'm thinking like the Hessians who came over in the American Revolution as mercenaries. But anyway, so you had these big like armies made up of people from their own country. So there's more of a patriotic flair to it.
I see.
And
an interesting distinction, though, because when you hire mercenaries to fight a war for you, I would imagine that their motivation to die for you is going to be much less than if you are dying for a cause that is part of your bones, so to speak.
Fair enough. I'm not sure how you manage mercenaries in a war. I've never tried. So not on my
really?
To-do
even
list.
From being from North Carolina, you've never...
No, South Carolina's been behaving itself. We haven't felt the need to invade. So...
No incursions.
There are our sister state. But anyway, the point is that you get this rise in nationalism in the 19th century, and a lot of it has to do with this expression of trying to assert a national identity in the face of a foreign power occupying. Mm. I'm thinking about the Bohemians, the Czechs, who were ruled by Austria and saw their own language being diminished and being sort of stripped away. Whereas German was the, I think, the language used in official proceedings, and I think, and I could be wrong on this too, I want to say Smetana's first language was German. I'll have to look up that to make sure I'm right on about that.
But I'm sure the blank stares looking at you are very comforting.
It's like,
sure, Larry.
Yeah, whatever you say. Okay,
you're the resident.
Somebody
expert.
Google that, I guess. But anyway, so I am. But the point is that there is this desire to like create a Czech identity, to not lose something. Mm. And that to me seems wholly noble. I mean, like, thanks a lot.
It was a budget truck.
Yeah, we didn't really need you talking about
it. What you said.
Yeah, he approved of my comments. Anyway, so the idea of expressing a national identity and showing your something about your culture seems like a wholly noble thing.
Yeah.
Like I don't fault Smetana for wanting to express Czech identity or writing an opera in Czech, The Bartered Bride, because they were trying to assert. I can see the benefit of it, but then you can also say, well, when is it becoming problematic? When is it becoming like we're claiming this for ours and that's not belongs to you anymore? And then, of course, cultural appropriation and things like that by within a nation of other people's cultures. So, it's a sticky topic. And the reason that it's important for us as conductors, and I'll end with this, I'm doing a bit of a filibuster, is that we have to think about, you know, the messages we send with the music we perform, but also about giving context through program notes, through pre-concert lectures, and like with all kinds of different issues. This is one of them that we might want to think about. Like, well, how do we contextualize this?
I think you're right. My understanding is nationalism is a modern concept too. I mean, modern in a way that it was sort of started to be something in 18th century. So it's not, it's a new thing, you know, and my understanding based on my studying is that it became a thing because of lack of identity. It was an identity crisis in that period because Christianity or like religions were fading out and people around the world is like, okay, like scholars and philosophers like Nietzsche and all these anti-Christ philosophers starting their work and they're basically saying, we're all human beings and the superpower human being, whatever, and maybe religion doesn't have a role here, and then all of a sudden you lose your sense of identity and then you need a replacement for it.
Yeah.
And that's where that's my understanding of the West, where nationalism started to be as a substitute for the identity means that you had, the religion. Okay. So yeah, but I don't know how much organic it is, because like when you're talking about like nationalism in music, it sounds like it's not organic. It just doesn't convey the nationalism if you don't explain it. You have to just create all these contextual information in order for people to understand. Oh, that's a national, you know. It's a music based on nationalism, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I don't know, and it goes back to what you were saying, like, is that a real thing? Do we, like, yeah, in 21st century, do we really agree that we have countries or borders? Of course, a lot of people, we know that they think that way, and a lot of other people, that they don't believe that at all.
Yeah. And so I don't want to minimize that, how important it is for people to feel that they have a sense of belonging and a home. I don't mean to say, like, you know, we shouldn't have that. But it can... That's the smallest, loudest truck I've ever seen in my life. But,
okay, go ahead.
I think overtly extreme nationalism can have negative consequences. I'm sorry, Ashkan, go ahead.
No, that's fine. Yeah. So, yeah, I think, like you said, the extreme consequence of nationalism, we all know that.
Yeah.
That happened. What happened as a consequence of thinking about one race and superior
preserving, to use an example, a local example, not
And there are some theories that that came out, like that Nazism came out of that concept that you didn't have an identity, you needed the created one, and then you brought this idea of race, which is in scientific world is not a thing at all. It doesn't mean anything. And then
it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. And so if you ask, like, people who are in genetics...
Right, because, like, we're all Homo sapiens.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, like, there's not a lot of differences between our genes.
I often wonder how people would react if there were still Neanderthals running around, or, you know, Homo erectus running around, or any of these other of our human cousins, because they wouldn't look exactly like us.
Yeah.
It'd be close, but it wouldn't be the same.
It wouldn't be the same. So then, I think that... again, I might be wrong. I don't know. Based on what I read, I think is that the whole Nazism was based on this Aryan race. That was the consequence of losing your identity all of a sudden, you know, and then you needed to replace it with something. Mm. And that could be like a consequence of like an extreme. But as far as like protecting your borders and just basically like protecting your home, you know, this is my... place, my property,
my personal space.
It's not a black and white issue. I mean, there's nuance to this, and I think it has something to do with our you know, our perspectives. McKeever, you wanted to jump in?
I did. I want to piggyback off of, you know, like what you guys are talking about as far as you know, identity and I guess like kind of sort of like finding a different voice. I mean, if we really look back, I mean, Ashkan, you know, was kind of right on the money when he said it's kind of the 18th century ideal that, you know, this kind of came about. But I think it possibly has something to do with the fact that now composers are no longer just kind of fixated in one particular area. You know, they're now composing from far corners of the world, and even though, you know, we still have, you know, some, you know, formulas that we adhere to as far as, you know, harmony and melody, rhythm and form as it is, there are little nuances that then kind of sort of give a composer, you know, their identity in what they're actually trying to achieve. And, you know, perchance, you know, it could be, you know, nationalism or, you know, thoughts and feelings from the homeland, but it could just be a way to distinguish their music from someone who comes from the same region that they are, or someone who doesn't come from the same region that they are.
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a... So, there is a, and this may be a little bit off the point of what you're saying, but like, I think there's also this feeling of in the 19th century of trying to, they felt like so dominated by the German, Italian, Austrian composers' styles that, like, especially, like, I think about the Russians, like Mazursky, wanted to, like, say, create, like, a Russian school, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, like, I don't see anything necessarily wrong with that. Yeah. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
No, I agree.
Well, I mean, sorry, if you don't mind.
Go, McKeever.
Jump in. Like, it's like, if you took, like, Rimsky-Korsakov versus Tchaikovsky, I mean, they obviously have some similar, you know, writing, but very different writing. You know, it's easier to tell that, you know, Rimsky-Korsakov has a more Russian sound than Tchaikovsky, even though they're both Russian, but what defines the Russianism in it, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's where I start thinking, too, because when you start talking about nationalistic music, I think it always, and I'm just speculating here, but for me, my understanding is that there's always some sort of like folk basis for this. So it kind of is like an outcropping of folk tune, folk dance, folk rhythm that then becomes something larger. You know, I think about Bartok or Dvorak or, you know, even any of the Russian composers from the late Romantic period or something like that. You start to see those elements, and I think that's why we define something as inherently a Russian sound or something that's an American sound is based off these little smaller nuggets, molecules of whatever was the folk music of the time. That
right.
sort of has then grown and changed and morphed into these larger soundscapes and then taken and fit into a Western music world of theory and composition. And I think there was this time for sure when composers were trying to reclaim the sound of their homeland.
Mm.
And so they went back to some of these rhythm and song ideas from the people, you know, so to speak.
I think it's also kind of tying in with the topic of last time when I was talking about the rise of the middle class as an important movement. And one of the things composers consciously did was trying to connect things to more of the folk traditions, you know, the more popular dances and things like that. So it could be kind of part of all of that. None of these things kind of have one source. So I mean, again, kind of going back to like, I don't see anything wrong if a composer or anything problematic about a composer incorporating stuff from their own culture. The issue it comes into play is when you're appropriating sometimes with that things. And then we start to get into exoticism. And I'm thinking about exoticism of the 19th century. I kind of keep going back to that. But appropriation goes up into the 20th century and even now. But something like, you know, Scheherazade even.
Debussy, you know? and Gamelan.
And even like Carmen, you know, Bizet. You know, the whole gypsy culture, as it were, Madame Butterfly.
And Stravinsky and Indian music, Indian rhythms.
Oh, right.
A lot of the complex rhythms comes from Indian
music. Oh, really?
Yeah, they're like, what do they call those?
Ragas.
Yeah.
Ragas, yeah. And, you see that, too. I mean, even back in Mozart's time with this whole fascination with the Moors and trying to incorporate the Moorish sound into opera and music. And
Moorish. Is that another term for Janissary?
Janissary bands. Yeah, and stuff that comes from North Africa and Turkey. And, you know, like, there's this fascination that the people had with these things. But, Larry, I think, you know, the idea of appropriation certainly is a lively topic these days because of the lens we have nowadays with, you know, what people term cancel culture, which is...
Oh, God.
I don't know how I feel about that term. I mean, I understand what's happening, but, you know, I think that's a ripe topic for us nowadays, too, is it right for a composer to say, this is what this is, but yet you're not native to that land or to those people, and try to claim that as, maybe it's your take on it, but there are people that do get really upset about that. But then I also think back to... Ashkan, you brought up the rise of Nazism and things like that. There was that period of time where they were so focused on a lot of that Germanic music that they sort of, like Wagner in particular, and so they would use that a lot in their propaganda, and then now that's become problematic for other people in other nations. We don't want to play Wagner because it reminds us of these people.
Yeah.
And is that fair to the culture? Is it fair to the composers? Is it fair to the audiences to limit the exposure of those composers because of this association that was taken?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I understand it, and I want to be sympathetic to those kind of things, but I think that's where it starts to become problematic.
I think with Wagner in particular, part of the issue is also his anti-Semitism.
Oh, absolutely.
It's people sort of think, well, you know, he wasn't a Nazi, but maybe he would have been if he was around at the time.
At what point do we stop separating the person from the product?
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's part and parcel of what they do, and it's awfully hard to separate.
Yeah.
But I wanted to throw a slightly different spin on this in terms of nationalism, because we always kind of refer to the composers and, you know, the material, the raw material, but I'm curious, I want to throw a hitch in here. The conductors in the room, have you experienced, when visiting different orchestras or working with different orchestras, have you experienced the phenomenon of a player coming up to you and saying, I disagree with what you're asking for, it's just not how we do it here? Have you ever had that happen to you?
No, I haven't, actually.
I think it's probably more common in different major orchestras where, I've talked with timpanists and trumpet players and brass players who say, oh, we always put a lot of front on the note here, or this is, we play slightly ahead here, or we do this and we do that because that's just what we do here.
Tradition.
I take that back. Okay. That happened to me in Bulgaria.
Ah.
Yeah, the orchestra I worked with over there. I cannot remember exactly what it was, but it was some sort of like practice. I wish I could remember.
Yeah,
you see, and it wasn't a big deal, and it was just sort of a small thing. And they went along with what I wanted to do, but they're like, they explained, like, oh, this is sort of a traditional thing that we do. And
do you remember what passage it was?
No, I can't remember.
Okay,
I can't remember.
But you see where I'm going, right? Like, there's different playing styles in different places. Yeah. If you do a Tchaikovsky symphony with the Russian National Orchestra, it's going to sound much different than it is with the French National Orchestra or with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And then even within those countries, like, Chicago sounds totally different than New York, then sounds totally different than Atlanta, and so on and so forth, and LA and San Francisco. They all have their own way of playing, their own styles.
Yeah.
So, like, between countries and also within countries, are differences in playing styles, what is that? What's that all about? Is that national?
I was going to say it's sort of similar to the concept of genre. Genre is sort of that way too. Like, for example, people who are, like, listening to just rock and roll genre, or I know that from data that metal fans are the most loyal music fans.
I wonder how they measure that.
And then, no, because Spotify, because they see that, for example, this user is always listening to metal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because, I mean, and I've been in that cult. I mean, it's sort of like, if you don't listen to metal, you're basically not part of this.
Oh, wow.
If you listen to, for example, something pop, it's just... And then a lot of rock and roll, like metal bands, for example, like Metallica, they hesitated to play with symphony because they thought it's not good. It's just not that masculine of it, you know?
Interesting.
So that's also in genre. And that genre is sort of global, you know? Like people around the world might actually opt in to just listen to a specific genre.
Okay.
So I'm just thinking, I think it's not a direct response to what you're saying, but I think there's this... That's another identity thing, you know. It's like we only listen to this. If you're not in this, we're not together, you know. One thing I wanted to go back to Larry's thought about nationalism again, what is appropriate and what not, as far as, for example, I'm from Iran. I was born in Iran, and if somebody like an American composer starts mimicking Iranian music, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I don't feel.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a weird person. Yeah. I'm not a good person.
I think we could all agree with that.
Yeah, but if it becomes problematic for me, it's where you put it in the context of you making fun of it, you sort of attribute like correlate some visual things to it to sort of say, oh, this sound is connected to this kind of a behavior that is we think the thing is funny.
Oh, I see.
Then it might be a little bit just offensive, you know. I still don't care because I personally think art should be open and you should be able to just convey whatever you want.
So if I may just briefly provide a more slightly more explicit example of like Puccini, Madame Butterfly, or something.
Right.
And he's got this very, what he would call, this is not me saying this, Oriental sound, which you can't say anymore, which if you ever could, I don't think it was ever appropriate. But it was a sound that went along with certain things happening in the opera, for instance, as like, oh, this is just, we're identifying this sound with this action of this culture, when really we don't know if that's the case. It's something that we've put on. Yeah,
like for example, I don't have any, I don't see any problem with Debussy using like gamelan stuff, and his own understanding. I think what it does, I think it lets people that say, oh, we have this aesthetic in the world too that could be amazing, and people get curious, like Wikipedia loophole, they just start learning about it, right?
But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but I don't think if he was using it in the wrong way, it's problematic. I think it's problematic, maybe it is. Again, not for me, because I just look at it, I'm just like, well, that's his opinion. You want to make fun of other like people. If this is a aesthetic you're searching for,
you're a free speech guy. I admire
exactly. So, but if you, exactly. If he's just doing it and he's doing it wrong, technically speaking, like if you're just taking a Persian tune and the tuning system is off, which you often hear, it's not offensive at all. And anyways, it's just like,
it's like having an accent, really. It's like you just can't replicate it without serious study and training.
Yeah.
So, the point I wanted to kind of get to, when I think of exoticism, I think of something that is trying to, well, let me put it this way. Like, if you are John Cage and inspired by the Gamelan Orchestra and you do prepared piano pieces that have that, I don't think of that as exoticism. I think of him taking it something and being inspired by it and writing something new. And you said the ragas that Stravinsky used. I mean, I didn't actually know that.
Yeah.
And so, but because like Stravinsky's not saying, oh, I'm writing this, this is supposed to be like Indian sounding music. I don't think he ever said that.
No, he was just inspired by it.
Exactly.
And he expanded his rhythmic ability.
But if you hold up and say, oh, well, this, I'm going to write this opera about, you know, set in Japan and I'm going to use these tropes, then it starts to get, I don't know, there's some kind of,
sort of equivalent to blackface.
It gets a little sticky. It gets a little sticky there. But I wouldn't want to say you can't be inspired by other cultures and write music. I would think that'd be terrible. I think we should learn from each other and be inspired and take some idea and run with it. But you can clearly draw lines where, or you can clearly see stuff that crosses over the line. You know.
So is the difference between,
let's take as an extreme example, like minstrel shows in the United States. You know, taking, you know. Elements of, you know, African American cultural music and turning into this stereotype, this ugly racist stereotype. Well, that's definitely wrong.
The intent is far different.
I had a thought when Ashkan was talking. It sort of made me think. Is this a product of this patriarchal society of world domination being a masculine thing? Is this us trying to force our, you know, our essence on everything and trying to control everything like traditional, you know, patriarchal society would try to do?
I have this conflict within myself all the time.
I'm wondering, is this just because the men were the ones that were writing all this music and that's the music that was produced and published and put out there? And so it's one more example of kind of like mankind pushing their agendas that way.
Yeah, they weren't just ignored, they were repressed too. Like, think of the Clara Schumanns out there, or the Fanny Mozarts, or...
Let me ask you, though, as conductors, when you're thinking about programming, are there definitely pieces you steer clear from because you're worried about what the audience perception may be?
Yes.
Why?
Okay, so I just thinking about this.
And the reason I'm asking is, and I've had these conversations as well with other people, but Ashkan brought up a good point, is let music be music. Why can't that musician's voice be heard?
Yeah.
Why do we then put this lid on it and say, well, that's problematic now? Well, okay.
Okay. For me, it comes down to showing respect in this particular kind of way. For instance, I was doing some programming for a choir, a chorus. And in our chorus library, we had several spirituals, you know, that were essentially derived from slave songs that ordinarily I would think, oh, you know, people love these are great. This time I actually paused and thought, wow, you know, why do we love these? Why do we think they're great? What is it about them that we are celebrating actually? And if I'm going to program this piece, is it my responsibility to use it as an opportunity to perhaps educate a little bit? I ended up deciding not even to go there this time around because of not only who I work with, and that's not to, to put anything on them or to insult them in the slightest. It's simply a matter of knowing your audience, I think, and being able to provide for the audience in a way that is appropriate, but also doesn't simply throw a bone to, shall we say, a token of this or that culture, simply to include it. I think there's a really fine line between paying respect to something and honoring it and simply throwing it a bone.
I think my take on that is, I think that it, context matters a lot. I think, in about being respectful, mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to sort of take a piece of music and not give proper credit to the culture that it came from.
Yeah.
I think if you do that and you say, like, this is why this is important,
yeah.
and this is why this is important to do these works, then I think that makes a difference. I think it makes all the difference in the world, in my opinion.
What I think also, I agree completely, and to take it kind of the next step, what I mean by respect is also in how we perform it. I have a really hard time seeing some ensembles being able to perform certain kinds of music in the style that it was intended. In other words, with the intent behind it. To just go right there and to talk about, you know, like a slave song, for instance, that's been turned into a spiritual of some sort. Is it okay for an all-white chorus to sing that?
Well, let me ask the question. Why would it not be?
Well, that's a good question.
Because the composer puts music out there expecting that somebody's going to perform it.
Yeah. This is the thing. Is a traditional, quote-unquote traditional song that's derived from a slave song, are we able to give a composer credit? Are we able to say this is...
Well, the origins of the song, probably not.
Yeah.
But I think what you... The arranger of the song, absolutely.
You give the culture that it came from visibility and credit.
Yeah. That's a sensitive thing, I think. It's because it can border on being insulting, I think, if it's not done in a way that is really representative of its original intent.
I think you make that clear, though.
Yeah.
You make the original intent clear. That's what I'm saying. You give it the context.
Okay, and then the last step of that is there are places, I think, where audiences would find that offensive, sadly.
Well, then that's a choice.
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
Well, then that's a choice of, like, well, you know, how much do you want to challenge your audience?
That's a good point.
That's another question.
Yeah, and potentially risk employment, even.
Yeah.
Over something as fraud
and
as race.
And that's another whole topic about, like, you know, where do we, what battles do we fight?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a great topic. But I think it all comes down to context. It all comes down to being very clear about this. Where these things come from, and as long as the things are done in a spirit of celebration and not mocking, like, to put it simply, like,
yeah,
like, you know, the with the minstrel show again being kind of the extreme example of it.
At what point, like, who decides what mocking is? Let me put an even more extreme example out there: an all-white chorus singing a slave song to an all-black audience. How does that come across?
I don't know that's a musical. I'd have to see the performance. If that's a musical interpretation of how they present it, or if it's how audience receives it, I can't control that.
I think that's a really interesting thing to think about.
Like, it is an interesting thing to think about. But at the same time, I also think why is it exclusively, is it only for one group of people?
Well, this is purely hypothetical, right?
I understand.
I'm just postulating these things to say these are the issues that we're dealing with in terms of what we bring to our audience and why.
Absolutely. And I think that's an important conversation to have. And I think every composer, conductor, performer, musician should have that thought and that, especially that internal dialogue about what is it I'm trying to accomplish by doing this.
I mean, I agree. I think what you're saying is it shouldn't matter. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like...
No, at a very basic level, it shouldn't matter.
Yeah.
And I absolutely agree with you that it's the context in how we're performing it, how we're presenting it, how we're explaining it. Mm-hmm. What is our intent?
And I think with the scholarly viewpoint, it would be interesting to actually see the result when a complete white chorus sings it, and then you have a complete black or African American chorus sings it, and then compare the two. and see the differences. And then you just make it a research topic.
I think that's fascinating. People are afraid to go there, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's a product of our time, especially. Yeah. You know, feelings are real. And people are very sensitive to things right now.
I take the position that it's better to over-talk something than it is to under-talk something. and if we go into something, some sort of social experiment or musical experiment where we can pose these questions and try to learn about things, I mean, there will always be people who say, oh, you're just doing this or that, you're causing trouble, or this is not appropriate to go to. There will always be those extremes, but I take the position that if we don't talk about them and ask questions that make us look ignorant, then we can never get past that ignorance.
And I think artists are on the front line.
I agree. Yeah. This is why I don't mind saying that. Like, you know, what about this and what about that? It's like, well, you can't really say that. I would never actually bring this up to a board for discussion, I don't think. It's just not appropriate.
It
would be a never-ending discussion. And unfortunately, it would have both sides probably bickering with each other.
Yeah.
And that's how it would end, I think. I don't want to... We can't predict that for sure, but...
McKeever, what do you think about all this?
What's the view from Wisconsin?
I mean... I can't remember who said it. You know, I think it was Matt who really kind of sort of put something as in terms of employment on the line. I mean, you know, when you make these decisions and, you know, even through asking questions, through doing thorough research, through trying to get your musicians on board, possibly trying to get your board on board and trying to get your audience on board, you know, I understand that, you know, you're risking everything in order to do something not necessarily outside of the box, but outside of the comfort zone, to be able to perform something that, you know, might not have a big performance track. You know, I think that there are just a lot of questions that one has to ask. Do the pros outweigh the cons? You know, what are the risks, and then what are the rewards going forward?
That's a good point.
Yeah. Well, the point is to examine these things. No clear answer to all this. Well, thank you guys so much for this robust discussion, and thank you, Hashcon, for your update about this critical bands stuff that's been going on.
We've got really the whole new levels. By the way, multiple levels.
Just a plug, if you want to hear more about what that was all about, we had a whole episode early on called Science.
Yeah.
So check that out.
And Ashkan, do you want to plug your website?
Sure, yeah. The Helix website?
Yeah, or whatever.
Yeah, digitalcontenthelix.com.
Digitalcontenthelix.com.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Website, check it out. Actually, we're going to update it really quick, like really soon.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. All right.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, the maestro is back. That means it is time for the rant.
Uh-oh.
So I have a rant today. This is a little change of topic, change of pace. Larry rants instead of Matt. But it's a gentle rant. So, you know me. I like to keep my finger on the pulse of what the kids are doing today in pop culture. I'm quite hip.
You're very hip.
Everyone knows. And apparently, on the TikToks, the sea shanties are quite popular. am I right? Yeah.
Are you serious?
On the TikToks.
I didn't know that TikTok was still a thing.
Apparently, it is. Oh. It's parents a thing. But anyway, so the sea shanties have kind of blown up. On TikTok, and here's my rant about this.
Is it the same sea shanty that they're using for all the videos?
All what videos?
Like TikTok videos. Is it the same song on every one, or are they just random sea shanties?
I think there's different sea shanties that people are picking up on different sea shanties. I've seen several different ones put up there.
Okay. Usually they zero in on one song that everybody uses.
Oh, I see. No, this is a variety of sea shanties.
Takes me back to my
there.
Wind Ensemble days.
Yeah,
all that Ray Fun Williams, it's good stuff.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
So, what's your rant about?
So
sea
the
shanties?
Rant is the rant. Okay. So when I think of TikTok, I think this is the dancing thing, right? Where they have a video and everybody does a little dance to it, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
So here's the thing. This is Larry's TikTok challenge. Is you like sea shanties? You like dancing? Why don't you do some hornpipes?
Oh.
Why haven't I seen hornpipe dancing? Hold on. truck is obviously interrupting my hornpipe conversation.
Oh, the joys of being outside again.
So if you like sea shanties, why don't you do the hornpipe, the sailor's dance? So, you know, where's TikTok on this is what I want to say.
You want me to call China and find out?
Get on the horn.
China owns TikTok.
Oh,
get on the horn.
Like the state owns?
Because I actually looked into this, and I could not find any hornpipe videos on TikTok. So that's the next thing.
What's the difference between a hornpipe and a sea shanty, Larry?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Matt.
I just gonna say, Larry, if you want a hornpipe TikTok, you're going to have to make it.
I'm not going to do that. So a sea shanty is a work song, right? Okay. For like, you know, keeping
scrumming
everybody moving
and rigging the lines. And
yes,
all that.
Exactly, and singing about ports and things of that nature. But the hornpipe is an instrumental dance. I think it's originally a Scottish dance or something. But anyway, it became associated with sailors. Some professional dancer in like 1740s or something like that danced it wearing a little sailor outfit on a stage. And then it became this thing associated with sailors, this hornpipe dance.
Now, is that cultural appropriation?
Oh, my gosh. All right. Now, yes. Yes. It could be. It could be.
1522 is the earliest association.
Oh, wow. There you go.
There you go.
All right. So, or even earlier than the mid-1700s.
That's almost 500 years old.
But, yeah. It's a little sailor's dance.
Whoa, there's a big bird of prey flying through the neighborhood over there.
Say what?
As a big bird of prey flying over there. Yeah, that is gorgeous. Birdus interruptus.
All right.
Oh, very good. Wow. That might be a hairier? I don't know.
Okay, anyway.
I got to look up my Peterson book here. I'm having my own nerd moment.
Fair enough.
Birds. Oh, anyway, sorry, Larry, didn't mean to interrupt your ranting here, raving.
Quite all right. But anyway, so the rant is TikTok, you do dancing to music. You do sea shanties. It's time for the hornpipe videos. Go. And if it becomes a thing, it was all started here in Conductor's Brew.
And while we're at it, add a saraband or a jig or two.
Yeah, well, no, it's just tying in with the sea. You get to keep it the sea.
Oh, hornpipes only is...
It's a sea song. Right. It's a sea thing. Okay, anyway,
as you wish.
That's my dumb rant for the day.
Brandon or Matt, any comment?
No?
I have no comment about sea shanties.
Okay.
Well, no, here's the thing, though. I'm going to tie you into this. Brandon, as a resident man of vocals, I think you should start a sea shanty segment on Conductor's Brew. You should lead us all in sea shanties.
Oh.
You know what I've always wanted to do is have my own barbershop quartet.
Oh,
can
my
we
God.
Do
I'm
that?
Down for that.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Matt, you need to get over here, man. Like, you're way too far away, dude.
We can't do barbershop with him on Zoom. We'll have to wait
for that's
what
I mean. It's what I'm saying. It's like, you gotta get back here in town, man.
Okay.
You can't do barbershop with me on Zoom.
No. But when you get back, we'll do barbershop quartet
and
or sea.
Brendan's obviously the soprano. I'll be the tenor and the bass at the same time.
I think he's a countertenor. I'm
more of a tenor. I've got a good falsetto, though. I can sing the part.
But no, I think we do some good sea shanties. You hold the bass down for us. I'm kind of in the little middle register.
And the coffee is kicked in here, so I think it's time for me to end the show because I have to go move around.
Matt's call of nature is calling the show to an end. Well, anyway, thank you for a winding and fun show. Thanks again for having us back in the front yard, Matt.
My pleasure.
It is.
Thank you for coming over and bringing all your gear, and thanks to Brandon and Matt and Ashcon for being back with us here as well.
Yeah, it's so nice to be in public and out in person,
great.
I should say, with
you
guys.
I've been looking at the foothills, and I swear there's about half as much snow up there now as there was when we started an hour or so ago.
All right, spring is coming.
Spring is in the air.
Coming fast.
Hiking
is calling at the sound of music.
I believe it's the hills are alive with the sound of music.
Yeah.
But we might have to pay money if we start singing that one. So.
We really got to sign out.
We got to go. All right. We're out of here, everybody. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back next week with more Conductor's Brew.
Cheers.